When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
You wouldn't expect to hear that we're America's third best city for beer like this one. Or home to vibes like this. And this. It might surprise you that we're top 10 for immersive art that's like,
whoa.
And?
Hmm.
Not to mention, we have one of the top zoos in the country. So can a city with the country's best pro soccer team, ranking as a top culinary destination in the world, be in your own backyard? Yes, Columbus. Plan your summer at experiencecolumbus.com/summer.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Julie, what is your relationship with fire? And by fire, I mean actual fire, not the American Gladiator fire.
Oh, right. Okay. Because I was going to say, like, definitely a big bonk on the head with a giant foam thing into water.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, of course, fire would have caused that. But no, my relationship to fire, it is, I wouldn't say it's complicated, but I would say, like, just like everybody else, there's something very alluring about fire, mesmerizing. Mm-hmm. My earliest memories were of course, burning ants with magnifying glass.
Okay. You were one of those kids.
I was definitely one of those kids. And then waving my hand over a candle flame with my babysitter. For a very long time. And while
like she was partaking of this with you, she was like, let's.
She and her hippie boyfriend were both like, let's do this thing.
So it was a hippie, not like a G. Gordon Liddy thing where you like hold your.
Okay.
Where you're like, look how macho and conservative I am because I can.
No,
hold
no, it was the opposite. It
palm.
Was like, let's try to control this fire, man. And now I cannot speak for them, but I will say that it's possible that maybe there was something that was enhancing the experience for them,
okay.
Looking back now and understanding teenagers then,
got it.
In the day.
They were hyped up on coffee. Gotcha.
Yeah, yeah. Lots of coffee. I'm
coffee
sure that
houses.
Was it. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, those were my memories of being absolutely mesmerized by fire. And you.
Well, I tend to think of fire as not so much an element, but a golden god that I honor.
Mm-hmm.
And when I bring fire into the world,
mm-hmm.
I am allowing a part of this god to re-enter the world and,
mm-hmm.
and destroy my
awfully
enemies.
Awfully familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I would say if I were a pyromaniac, perhaps, as we'll discuss in this podcast, because that's the thing. Because my history with fire is probably mostly uninteresting. Yes, when I was a kid, I had a stage where I went through where I really liked firecrackers,
mm-hmm.
and it was fun to strap them to the backs of little G.I. Joe men and just stick them into the dirt and watch things blow up. And,
yeah.
And you know, and I love poking around in the fire. I was in Boy Scouts, so there's a lot of poking around in the fire. But eventually I kind of outgrew that. So I like staring into the fire. I like flames. There's something you know, kind of scary about it. If I feel like I left a flame going in, say, in the bathroom in the morning, I will freak out and probably turn the car around or turn my walk around and go back to the house to address it. But I mean, fire is amazing. Fire is beautiful.
It is.
So we can't help but be fascinated by it. But it's probably a bad thing if we're too fascinated by it.
Well, the crazy thing about it is that, of course, when we discovered fire, it really helped us out, right? People, as a civilization, as the ability to even exist as humans today, right?
Right. It really, as we've discussed in the past, it really made a huge impact on the way that we hunt our food. For mm-hmm. instance, you could use fire to clear out the vegetation around a watering hole, so mm-hmm. you could see the prey animals that were creeping toward the water to drink and then
right.
slay them. And then once you had slain the prey animal, you could conceivably roast it up and get more out of your meal,
right.
Digest things that were normally not something you could digest.
That's right. You would
not just
the
meat,
ability to transform foods that you wouldn't be able to digest.
Right. And to say nothing of its use as a destroyer and as a weapon.
Right.
I mean, fire has pretty much always played a role in human warfare. I mean, from the flaming arrow to a flaming stick to napalm, to the idea of nuclear firestorms ravaging the continent following some sort of a World War III scenario. So, I mean, fire is a big player in human civilization, in our hopes and fears.
And I guess what we're trying to do is trying to occupy the mindset of someone who would be so in love with fire. And be romancing fire, because on some level we all understand that, again, you know, fire is the life giver, it's the destroyer. Mm-hmm. But some people, a very small percentage of the population, pyromaniacs specifically, are absolutely obsessed with it.
Right.
And so we're going to try to get, into their minds a little bit today, although we will say that this is territory that hasn't been greatly explored for many reasons.
Right. Now, we're not going to get into the chemical reaction of fire, but just a quick mention here. We have an excellent article called How Fire Works by Tom Harris on HowStuffWorks.com. Just go to the website and type in How Fire Works, and you'll go right to it. Here's a quote from it. Fire isn't matter at all. It's a visible, tangible side effect of matter changing form. It's one part of a chemical reaction, which, you know, just a quick quote from just what fire is. But mm-hmm. it gives you a little more idea that we're a little insight into why it's so fascinating, because it is – it's a thing between, you know, and it's in addition to being this life giver, this destroyer. And you also, I've heard it argued that like every story we've ever told is essentially a story of campfires, you know, like when we sit around the campfire, there's this primal experience of humans with their light, with their warmth, and then beyond them, the darkness of the rest of the world.
Well, and then there's a mysterious element of it too. I mean, you know, when you take a candle and you turn it, to the right or left, it's always going to point up. And of course,
unless you're on a spaceship.
I was about to say, that's gravity at work for you, unless you're on a spaceship. And then you get to see the blue flame and the red flame, which is really just the embers of that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's something really powerful to that. But again, some people, they get a little bit too excited by this flame. And
well, let's look at some examples of people who are too into their fire making.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so there's an infamous arsonist, right, who has a lot of the characteristics of a pyromaniac, and it hasn't, you know, exactly been said this is a pyromaniac. And again, we'll talk about why later.
But if he's not, he's at least on the waiting list.
He's definitely on the waiting list. Looks like he might make it. Paul Keller lives in Seattle. He is now serving a 99-year prison sentence, and he started setting fires as a child and later tried to join the fire department. And he's an alcoholic, and during those fires, most likely he was probably imbibing, but he set something like 70 fires in his career, and one at a nursing home facility. So obviously there's, you know that there's a dark side to this, but that's when you know that someone has certainly tipped over the edge of perhaps just seeing what a fire might do in some sort of scenario, and then actually setting a fire knowing that many lives will be taken.
Right. Another big case that ran across was one that mentioned in some of the literature. This British psychiatrist by the name of Randolph Parks, he did a whole paper in 2005 looking at this 20-year-old homeless individual who's not named in the study,
mm-hmm.
but he was actually going around dousing people with lighter fluid and setting them on fire.
Yeah.
And he also had a number of other symptoms. Like it was this guy was kind of out there because he was like hearing breathing in his bedroom and seeing mm-hmm. blood on the wall. He reported having seen ghost-like people that looked like water.
So he was having hallucinations.
Yeah, he was having hallucinations.
That's a bummer. So on the light side, there's the porta potty pyromaniac.
Oh, okay.
This was in San Francisco a couple years ago. And he torched more than 20 porta potties over a 2-month period. And would do this primarily at night, although he could have very well been a woman. He or she was so bold enough as to actually set one on fire during the daytime, in which you could see the porta potty combusting in all its glory with all of its elements flying through the air.
Well, you know, there's probably a study out there that we should look at on porta potty vandalizing in general, because it seems like there's something about the porta potty that humans are compelled to mess with it. I guess because it's this little room that's full of poo, and there's something in everyone that wants to tip it over or hit it with a car or catch it on fire, right?
No. Maybe you. I think we just got a little insight there.
Maybe I just don't. I mean, I'm not a big porta potty fan, so maybe it's part of my rage against the.
Maybe it's your fear.
Yeah.
It's like you trying to master your fear of porta potties by imagining them being tippled over.
Like seriously, I went into one recently and it had a grated floor like a milk carton, like it had holes in it. You
mm-hmm.
know? It's how why did it take us that long to figure out that a porta potty needs holes in it so that it's not slick with mud and other matter when someone goes into it after it's been up for a day or two?
Well, I mean, there's always room for progress, right?
I guess.
Yeah.
I told you how I was almost carried away in one at Coachella one year, right?
No.
It was now. Granted, it was not just a normal porta potty.
Okay, so this is why you have the fear. Tell us.
Well, it was not just a normal porta potty. They had those too, and they mm-hmm. were disgusting, of course. But they also had ones on the back of a truck, which is like this big. It's like a full-size bathroom, you know, with sinks and all.
Yeah.
Kind of fancy, but also kind of gross.
So this is like the Cirque du Soleil kind of porta-potty.
Yeah, yeah. And I had gone in, and I didn't know this, but they were closing it up, and they were about to take it away on the back of a truck with me still in it. And then some guy, like, hollers something, you know, unintelligible. Mm-hmm. I can only call it a holler because it was that, you know, unintelligible, through the door and then shuts it. I'm like, I wonder what he's yelling about. And so I finish my business and I rush to the door and they're getting ready to haul it off, probably to throw it over the edge of a canyon somewhere, I guess.
No, I'm just imagining that it was some sort of elaborate plot to kidnap you and then force you into labor in some remote part of the world.
So. I didn't necessarily want to start it on a fire, but
now you do. Yeah. Now you've got these feelings about porta potty that you are unresolved that perhaps fire could help with.
Maybe yeah. Fire could help me with that.
All right, yeah. Let's swing back to the fire there. That's a fun little porta potty diversion. Okay, so what is pyromania? Right. The term actually comes from French physician Charles Chrétien. And it's monomanie incendiary, apologies for my French, which translates to insane incendiarism.
Oh, okay.
So the term's kind of vague, right?
Well, it's in the same way that insanity is often a term that is contested and depends on who's throwing it around and who's
right.
receiving it. You look across the board and people have different definitions of who qualifies as insane and who qualifies as a pyromaniac.
Which is really interesting, too, because if you look at this criteria of what is a pyromaniac, I mean, there's a very big lack of insanity in this list, right? It's kind of actually spelling out this story of someone who is perfectly normal except really likes fires.
Right. And just to give another nod to how loose the terminology can be, the FBI organized an advanced fire investigation training session
mm-hmm.
a little while ago. And at the start of the meeting, they asked over 600 participants, which included fire agency personnel, like insurance investigators, police officers, mental health professionals, various walks of life, to write down their definition of pyromania, and not a single definition was identical.
Well, and this is part of the problem, right?
Right.
As we have discovered here, and many are discovering in the field, is mm-hmm. that it hasn't been studied that well, and there's a lot of misinformation out there that we'll get to. But so far, the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders has set forth the following criteria for a diagnosis of pyromania.
And I can't help but think, as we go through this, let's think of one of the more famous pyromaniacs or potential pyromaniacs, from popular culture, that being Beavis of Beavis and Butthead.
All right.
As you remember, he was rather enamored with the golden flame.
Yes, well, and also Bart Simpson.
Oh, was Bart big into the fire?
I think that's what landed him in detention a couple
times.
Okay,
well, let's think of Bart and Beavis as we proceed.
Okay. All right, first, the individual must have set fires deliberately and purposefully on more than one occasion.
Okay, definitely on Beavis, and I assume on Bart. That show's been going on too long for them to gone to that well more than once.
I agree, and at least during the episode.
Right.
That would have been many times. The individual must be tense or exhibit outward emotional behaviors. We're talking about facial expressions, changes in voice, excitement before setting fires.
Definitely Beavis, yes.
The individual must be interested in, curious about, fascinated with, and or attracted to fires and their situations.
I think that kind of goes – that one's kind of silly because that kind of goes with the territory.
Yeah. The individual must experience pleasure, tension relief, or gratification after setting fires or watching fires in their aftermaths.
Yes.
This is obviously probably the biggest marker here, right?
Yeah. Like, it's kind of like the whole thing, like a fire. I think there was like a Far Side cartoon where there's a building burning and the people are turning and noticing, like, the dude that's just sitting there with just wide eyes and just loving every minute of it. Like, that's the guy that you kind of suspect might have pyromania issues.
Yeah, yeah. The guy with the kaleidoscope eyes is definitely. Other psychological disorders cannot better account for the individual's fire-setting behavior, manic episodes, antisocial behavior.
Okay. So, for instance, if they're seeing things in the night, bleeding walls, and then decide to go set hobos on fire.
That's a byproduct.
Yes.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
We're talking about pure pyromania here.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And then the individual has no other motivations for setting the fire, like financial gain.
All right. This is like insurance. I need insurance money, so I'm going to burn my own building down.
Yeah, my restaurant's not doing that great. Oops. Kitchen fire, expressing social or political ideas.
Okay. Obviously, burning down, a building as a sign of protest.
Burning people in effigy.
Right.
Right. Revenge or anger.
Right. This is, I don't like you. You said something bad to me, or I think, or even like, I perceive that you wronged me in some fashion. So I'm going to burn your cubicle down.
For any of the, TLC hip hop fans out there, Lisa Left Eye Lopez, I believe, burned down her fiancé's mansion because of this.
Oh, yes, yes, that's right.
This was in Atlanta. So
TLC, I guess after the Learning Channel, but I'm thinking about our own
It
channel.
It was TLC, right?
Yeah. I was thinking it was a show because I'm not as familiar with all the TLC programming, so I thought maybe there's like a pyromania ladies.
Yeah, and I've got one foot in there, so you thought, oh, Julie, she's just talking about TLC.com again. Enough of Cake Boss, Julie. Okay, so hiding other criminal activity, concealing a murder or theft, right?
Right, getting rid of a body by burning it.
Yeah, something dark like that.
Yeah.
Improving his or her living circumstances, which I don't really get. I get the financial gain, but you would think that would be one and the same. Responding to delusions or hallucinations or impaired judgment, dementia, mental retardation, alcohol, or drug intoxication.
Yeah, what is improving his or her living? It's kind of like, this living room's great, but I feel like it would be better if I burned half of it.
It would be really shabby chic if I could just, get a little singe to some of this furniture. Also, the individual must not exhibit intoxication, criminal motivation, or other criminal psychiatric disorders. So when you take all of this, it's purely like this, that one point, which is like point number four, then the individual must experience pleasure, tension relief, or gratification. So that's really at the heart of this matter. And just as a little side fact, in the U.S., only 3% of suspected arson fires lead to conviction. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then from Slate.com, the science of pyromania, they say maybe the true arson-prone pyromaniacs are still roaming the streets. Some evidence suggests that arsonists tend to be non-assertive offenders who internalize their anger with fires, enabling them to avoid face-to-face confrontation. Such evasiveness also makes them difficult to study. So what they're kind of, what all this is painting right here is that it's very hard to study who a true pyromaniac may be. And in fact, there's probably a lot of crossover from arsonists to pyromaniacs.
Right.
If you kind of lift some of these constraints, especially the alcohol part, right? If someone's using alcohol and they set a fire, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're not a pyromaniac, especially if they did that 70 times over the last 4 months.
Right. I was looking at this article from the American Institute of Forensic Education. that was talking about characteristics of, quote, juvenile fire setters.
Mm-hmm.
Because the whole thing is you're going to have juveniles who are setting fires, and they are not necessarily pyromaniacs as we've discussed,
mm-hmm.
Given these constraints. So some of the examples they lay out in this article include the experimental curiosity fire setter.
Mm-hmm.
And this is generally somebody younger than 7. And they're generally, after they set the fire, they're generally quite upset by it. And it's more of a product of lack of supervision and easy access to fire setting materials.
Yeah.
So this would be like, you leave a cigarette lighter around a 6-year-old, there's nobody watching him. Of course, he might set something on fire. That's
yeah.
why you don't leave the fire making implements around when they're on their own.
Generally, yeah.
Right. Like, we leave an axe around my nephew and he starts chopping in a tree with it. It doesn't mean he's an axe wielding maniac. He's just a kid who sees an axe and nobody's watching, so he's going to start swinging it. It's just what they do.
It's true. They do.
Then there's the thrill seeking fire setter, and this is 11 to 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
This tends to be interrupted by the time they reach 16 or 17, the article says, but it can become more dangerous over time. They're generally doing other bad things, and they tend to enjoy the drama and the chaos that the fire creates. And they're often good manipulators. They're shallow. They're selfish. They like a moral compass.
So they're a little bit narcissistic.
Right. And this is definitely one you can see, like I say, becoming a more serious threat. It's
mm-hmm.
not just a kid playing with fire. It's a
right.
kid playing with the emotions that a fire evokes in people.
Right. And realizing that they can get attention from this or pleasure from this, from the attention that the fire gets.
Right. Because a fire always gets attention.
it's pretty true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then there's another classification, delinquent fire setter. And this is 11 to 12 year old. And generally these are individuals who, set the fire and then they're denying personal liability for the fire. They're blaming others. And it's generally more of a hyperactivity and impulsive thing. So it's kind of a continuation of that experimental curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
But it has more with just, lacking, a control over
and
themselves.
The impulse control is pretty important.
Right.
Too.
Impulse
yep.
control.
Yeah.
And so they're like, I'd like to set a fire and bam, they're already setting it.
Yeah.
Then they also classify revenge fire setters.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, this, according to what we discussed earlier, this would not be a pyromaniac,
mm-hmm.
but.
And this is why it gets so murky, right?
Right.
Because it's been studied in many different ways and labeled in many different ways.
Right. And this would be like a 15-year old or older. And, they may be taking revenge against a society, a person, an institution, a particular group. It
mm-hmm.
could be a perceived wrong or a real wrong.
Mm-hmm.
These fire setters generally express anger before the fire and relief after. They often come from intact families with cold, withholding parents and a paranoid way of thinking.
Huh, that's really interesting. Again, I keep seeing markers of narcissism because usually with people who are narcissistic, they have parents who have turned away from them, which makes them turn inward
mm-hmm.
and begin to become, the seeds of narcissism begin to grow. So that's sort of interesting to hear that.
Cool. And then the other category that they lay out in this article, disordered coping fire setters. And this is generally early childhood onset. And these are tend to be very dangerous. This is a situation where fire, it is a learned response to stress. They're generally male. And these fire setters, they experience problems with pretty much every aspect of their life. They often
mm-hmm.
come from a history of violence. There's abuse or neglect issues at home, and they will set a fire, say every day.
Yeah.
And the size doesn't matter. It might be just burning something in the sink
mm-hmm.
or setting fire to a tool shed. It doesn't matter to them. But setting the fire, like,
the
lowers the stress.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it's a stress relief mechanism.
Huh, that's pretty interesting. All right, so we're going to take a break, but when we get back, we're going to talk about what Freud, Prometheus, and penises have to do with fire.
Yes.
This podcast is brought to you by Intel, the sponsors of tomorrow, and the Discovery Channel. At Intel, we believe curiosity is the spark which drives innovation. Join us at curiosity.com and explore the answers to life's questions.
All right, we're back. So Prometheus, of course, was the fire bringer from mythology.
Right.
Who brought
stole the secret of the fire.
He was a titan. Mm-hmm. Brought the secret of the fire down from the gods, mm-hmm. who overthrew the titans, and shares it with humans. So humans can do all these things we were talking about, like cook food and drop napalm and burn down all the shrubbery around a pond so they can eat the animals that drink from it.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up finding himself chained to a rock while an eagle feasts on his liver, correct?
Right, but the liver grows back, and so each day the his liver becomes a meal again. So that's a great punishment. But so he smuggled the fire in a hollow fennel stalk, and Freud, our man Freud, saw this as a penis symbol.
Ah.
And this is, this is from the Slate article about pyromania. And it says, psychiatrist Candace Germain and Michael LaJoy explained it as, sort of invoking the mechanism of reversal. So Freud suggested that it was not fire that man harbors in his penis, but the means of extinguishing fire, the water of his stream of urine. But Freud also saw a morbid curiosity of fire as being related to excessive nocturnal enuresis, bedwetting in children, with the erotically tinged warmth associated with ambient urine, essentially trapping problem bedwetters in the phallic stage usually reserved for 3 to 6 years old.
Ah. Okay.
Of course, Freud shows up on the scene.
Yeah, and it's interesting that he did mention the whole peeing on the fire, because I don't remember ever peeing on a campfire, but I know that was always a big deal in Boy Scouts.
I would say that if I had the plumbing, I probably would do that.
Yeah.
But I don't, so I can see how that would be interesting to do. Another thing from that Slate article that was really interesting is that in the 18th century, German physicians were convinced that fire-setting tendencies were primarily an affliction of teenage girls with low IQs, and that burning things gave these girls an outlet for their sexual frustration.
Ah, and they called it Feuerlust.
Feuerlust, right, firelust. Which, you know, I think has actually come to paint the way that we understand pyromania. Because a lot of people have taken this idea of pyromaniacs as sociopaths and people who are sexually disgruntled and they're just working out their fantasies, their sexual problems, so on and so forth. Which we know is not necessarily true.
Right.
But, of course, that's what really rings well with a story. In fact, there's something called the McDonald triad, and it's basically this correlation of animal cruelty, which has been linked with obsession with fire setting and bedwetting beyond the age of 5. So if you have all three of these traits or these behaviors, then you probably have more sociopathic tendencies. At least that's what the reasoning is.
Right.
So you can understand why this idea of pyromaniacs is sexually frustrated or bedwetters came to rise in our minds. In fact, we know that this is a problematic suggestion that these three behaviors creates a sociopathic tendency in a person. And in fact, we recently found out in the book by Hal Herzog, Some We Eat, Some We Love, and Some We Hate, that this association with serial killers and animal cruelty is just pretty much plain wrong.
Right. It's all about the child sort of testing the boundaries and figuring out where they rank in relation to animals.
Right, right. And in fact, it's really common for kids to have some sort of level of animal cruelty or experience with it, because they are trying to master this position of power in their life and try to, mm-hmm. to suss it out for themselves. But according to Hal Herzog, the majority of people who abused animals as children do not grow up to be violent, and 80% of serial killers do not have a known history of cruelty to animals. And he found this out by a myriad of studies were taken out I believe they were sociopathic prisoners that they studied, and they really found no correlation there.
It's interesting, the I'm thinking about like children, young children sort of discovering these things for the first time, like mm-hmm. discovering the whole I can be cruel to an animal and what does that mean and how do I relate to the animal,
mm-hmm.
and then discovering lying. We discussed lying in one of the other podcasts, and about discovering that power, the ability to say something that isn't so, and therefore alter the perceived universe of another person or even themselves.
Yeah.
And then so fire kind of fits in naturally with that, to discover this ability to create this strange substance, to create it or control it,
mm-hmm.
or to just release it onto something. And, you know, you can just imagine like a young mind, like what they must think of fire.
Yeah, it's another opportunity to either empathize or to destroy, right?
Right. And I wonder too how it about pyromania, how it factors into different walks of life, because there are certain places in the world, certain families in the world. I mean, it varies depending on your upbringing, how exposed to fire you are. Mm-hmm. I mean, for some, you're going to be seeing fire every day. You're going to be playing in the fire from an early age, while in other households or environments, the fire is not going to be something that is readily available. Mm-hmm. Especially if you know there are no smokers around, there are no campfires around. If everything's just like electric heat, you know.
Well, I think that's why it's so hard to understand and to study, because it is colored by a person's perception, and there's mm-hmm. not all. I mean, other than setting the fire, there's not a lot of a common thread.
Right.
Between people who are pyromaniacs. I mean, there are accounts of people who, like, for instance, I'm thinking about this one guy who's a pyromaniac, and he had it, for him, it was a sexual release.
Right.
And he had some, but he had some very, important problems, mental disorders that led him to create this association between sex and fire. For instance, you know, he had a strange relationship with his mom, and she made him put his hand on a burner to understand that it was hot. And there were all these instances of fire throughout his young adult life that he began to map against his sexuality, which then came out in fire setting.
Right.
So, but that's particularly only for that one person, right? But again, very hard to understand, very hard to study. True pyromania is actually really rare. We're talking about less than 1% to about 4% of arsons.
Hmm. And then there's a whole other area that comes to mind when you're talking about pyromania, or rather people who are really into fire, but not necessarily pyromaniac.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've been to several different festivals or events where you have people that are really into fire.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're into using stunt burn suits.
Yeah.
They're into building their own flamethrowers.
Pyrotechnicians. Yeah.
Right, right. And they love fire. There's no denying that these guys and gals really, at least figuratively, get off on the idea of catching things on fire, including themselves.
Right.
Fire
in the hole.
Yeah, yeah. Look for any, images from any given, say, Burning Man. And the pyromaniacs, I'm using the term loosely, but people who are really into fire, they tend to really seek those events out.
Yeah, you know, Burning Man keeps coming up, and someone had suggested we do a podcast on it. So, I don't know, maybe we can find a science angle there.
Yeah, well, we've discussed there are plenty of scientists at Burning Man.
That's so, right. Yeah. That's right. You can just go, I think, give them like 25 cents and ask an astrophysicist a question.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a booth there, what we're suggesting, that you can go and visit and not only just enjoy the Burning Man, but also learn more about the physical world.
The Burning Man. That sounds like if somebody's grandma were like, are you going to the Burning Man this year?
The Burning Man.
You were talking about the effigy that they burn, right?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. The big giant one at the end of the festival.
Yeah. Yeah.
That people would writhe uncontrollably in front of.
And again, I think it comes back to the reason people get into that though, and love the idea of a huge bonfire, because it's a story of human civilization. It's people gathering around this fire.
Something they create. Yeah.
That brings warmth, that allows them to digest different food, that gives them power over the elements and over the other creatures of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the outside, the darkness of the unknown, of the dangerous, of the unexplored.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just stirs something deep within us.
Right. And it really complements peyote. All right. So what we do know about pyromaniacs, or what we suspect, is that it is an impulse control disorder, much like kleptomania or pathological gambling, right?
Okay. Yeah, so how do we treat it?
Behavioral therapy so far. That's what most psychologists are thinking. But in a 2006 letter to the editor of the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry, psychiatrist John Grant reported a case of one patient who fit the clinical definition of pyromania, the one that we talked about. And Grant was able to examine the brain of his patient with SPECT imaging and found a region in the left inferior frontal portion that had a low blood flow. So the patient underwent 3 weeks of daily behavioral therapy and a daily regimen of topiramate, which is an anticonvulsant used to treat seizures.
Ah.
And during that time, the patient reported a substantial decrease in his urge to set fires. And then when Dr. Grant re-imaged the patient's brain, he found that that area was no longer there, that the problem, the low blood flow no longer existed. So there's this idea that it could be biological.
I've also read that if we were to treat it like an impulse control disorder, such as pathological gambling or kleptomania, we might look at the serotonin centers of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
We might be able to treat them with selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors.
Okay.
So
yeah.
Basically antidepressants.
Yeah, basically try to replace that behavior with the feeling that the reuptake inhibitors would give them, right?
Right.
Or the serotonin.
Or maybe you get them really into the idea of using flamethrowers at big events in the desert. I don't know.
But, I mean, maybe that's right. Maybe they get to put the torch to the burning man.
Yeah. So there you have it. Pyromania. You actually threw the question out on our Facebook group.
Mm-hmm.
What is your relationship to fire? And so we definitely would like to hear from everyone. Like, really, you don't have an excuse to not have an opinion on fire. It's not like we're asking about an obscure Doors album or something. We're talking about fire.
Yeah,
so, you know, I'm very curious, like, how does your upbringing relate to it? Like, for me, it's like I remember, like, early on, we would go on camping trips or my dad would be grilling, you know, on the back porch or something. So there was always, not always, but there was frequently fire around. And I definitely played in the fire.
Yeah.
So,
and we got some really great responses on Facebook. And everybody did have a different experience. Although, you know, some people were ant killers like I was. That seems to be a common theme.
So yeah, let us know about that. And if you want to find us on Facebook, just do a search for Stuff to Blow the Mind. That's how you find us on there. And we're also on Twitter, as Blow the Mind. And we update those pretty regularly. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me reach into the listener mail bag here real quick. Thank you, robot. Laura writes in and says, "Hi, Robert and Julie. In regards to your comments on Japanese doll women, probably my favorite synonym for Lolita in Living with Robots, Can We Build a Better Bot? I must correct Robert in that the darker sister of Lolita is referred to as Gothic Lolita. This is defined as a style similar to Lolita, which is the way of dressing as though one is an often female Victorian child, complete with many, many lace frills. Through mixing, as the name suggests, a dark color palette. Though it is most popular in Japan, I am a frequenter of a few Gothic Lolita stores in Europe and in the great smorgasbord of Camden Market, and speak from my own experience. Just to clear things up, thanks for providing an informative and mentally stimulating podcast, Laura." So there you go. Yeah, I got that a little mixed up there. I think I was thinking of kawaii, the whole, like, and I may be saying that.
Kawaii,
mm-hmm. the cute.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's kawaii noir, which is dark cute.
Okay,
so this is
gotcha.
Similar, but it's, this was the Gothic Lolita. So the,
okay.
Like she said, frills, but black frills.
On a side tangent here, too, when we were doing research for this, my eye landed on something called Koro. I hope I have that right. K-O-R-O, from what I understand, and I didn't pay a lot of attention to it because it didn't really relate to this podcast, but it is Japanese and it's sort of a weird thing, is that there's this idea that your genitalia can retract and there's this irrational fear.
That they may just completely retract into your body?
Yeah.
Huh.
So there you go. I don't know. Maybe we need to do a podcast on irrational fears.
I can understand that. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it was one of those things I was like, that is bizarre. But yeah, I could understand how somehow that could get in someone's mind and you would start to really fear that, especially as a child.
Yes. Yes. Well, there's a whole host of fears that can be associated with genitalia as a child.
I'm sure.
Especially if nobody bothers to explain to you what is going on with them or should be going on with them. But that's, again, a whole
other thing. Yeah.
But yeah, so maybe that's an upcoming episode. I don't know. So, hey, someone wants to, we already talked about Facebook and Twitter. What if someone wants to send us some email and have the robot bring it to us?
Oh, very easy. All you have to do is send us a line at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow.
You wouldn't expect to hear that we're America's third best city for beer like this one. Or home to vibes like this. And this. It might surprise you that we're top 10 for immersive art that's like...
Whoa.
And...
Hmm.
Not to mention, we have one of the top zoos in the country. So can a city with the country's best pro soccer team, ranking as a top culinary destination in the world, be in your own backyard? Yes, Columbus. Plan your summer at experiencecolumbus.com/summer.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
Managing your diabetes just got easier. The powerful new Dexcom G7 lets you see your glucose numbers on your compatible watch and phone without fingersticks. And because Dexcom G7 is the most accurate CGM system, you can be confident in your food, exercise, and medication decisions. And all those decisions can lead to big results, like more time in range and lower A1C. Get started at Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.